Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, Ed Sheeran tells the High Court he's no song thief. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we're going to take a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when the RIAA announced its stats for 2021, which showed that the US recorded music market grew by 23% in 2021.
Yes, regular listeners of Setlist will know, obviously, that the RIAA is the Recording Industry Association of America, as we've discussed frequently on Setlist. Some people might argue too frequently. Terrible initials to say out.
Yeah.
But the RIAA's latest stats pack summarizing recorded music revenues in the US, biggest recorded music market in the world, of course, last year. So as you say, yes, they were up. I mean, we knew that already, didn't we? Record industry stats are all positive at the moment, have been for a number of years. But we found out, yes, when we look at retail revenues in the US, things were up 23%, slightly less if we look at wholesale, but only slightly. I think it was like 22% if we look at the wholesale figures. We know, obviously, that growth is powered by the streaming boom, the ongoing streaming boom. But how much is it powered by the streaming boom? Well, the figures from the RIAA confirmed in 2021, 83% of total recorded music revenues came from streaming. That's all the different streaming services combined. So it would also include Facebook and Instagram and TikTok. It would include the online radio services licensed through Sound Exchange in the US. It would even include Peloton. But really, when we say streaming is powering growth in the record industry, we mean premium streaming. And so the RIAA confirmed that of the 83% of total recorded music revenues, 76% came from the sale of premium subscriptions, which means, if you do the maths, about two-thirds of the money that the American record industry made last year came from selling subscriptions by Spotify, Apple, Amazon, etc.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that good old physical releases didn't play a part too. Vinyl sales were up by 61% last year to just over $1 billion. That's the first time that the vinyl format has generated more than $1 billion since 1986. CDs were up as well by 21% to $584 million, though that's still down on 2019 because CDs just did really, really badly in 2020 because of that pandemic thing we had that I think's gone now. And that's why they're back up again this year. Rest assured, they're still falling. But I mean, maybe they'll plateau one day. Overall, physical products accounted for 11% of total 2021 US recorded music revenues. And that's a slight increase on recent years. The remaining 6% of the money, if you've been adding up all of the percentages so far, came from downloads, which accounted for 4%, and sync, which accounted for 2%.
Now, with that top-level growth that we said at the start, 23% up overall, the US recorded music market last year at a retail value. So that comes in at just over $15 billion. Why is that a significant figure? Well, if you go back to the peak of the record industry in the good old days when it was all about CDs back in the 1990s. The record industry basically peaked before the whole digital calamity of the 2000s in 1999 at 15 billion. So on one level, it means thanks to the streaming boom, the record industry is back where it was in the heyday of CDs in 1999, unless you adjust the figures for inflation, of course.
Oh, yeah, no, if you do that, it's no good at all. I mean, it's still down by 37% on that 1999 peak, when you adjust for inflation.
But who wants to adjust for inflation? Nobody.
No one.
Don't adjust for inflation. It will only make things depressing.
Yes, and I mean, there's a lot of other stuff in the RIAA's report. Was that too many A's?
Wasn't counting.
I don't know. We could, of course, do a whole section on it on this episode of the show, as we did last week with the Entertainment Retailers Association's UK retail stats. But we reckon now we're just going to hang on for the IFPI's global stats, which should be out later this month, and will tell us how everything went across the globe in 2021.
Yeah, stop focusing on individual countries. Who cares about individual countries? Let's wait for the IFPI report due out towards the end of the month, which will gather stats from every single country. Well, not every single country. Every significant recording music market in the world. So that's something to look forward to. But it does mean that stats are not what we're here to talk about this week.
No. Later on, we'll be discussing the return of LimeWire. But first, Ed Sheeran was in court last week in a bid to defeat a song theft lawsuit filed against him and his musical collaborators in relation to his 2017 song Shape of You. Now, lawsuits where artists are accused of ripping off the work of other artists in such a way that it constitutes copyright infringement have become pretty common in recent years, of course. Just last week, Sam Smith and Dua Lipa were both sued over similar allegations. Dua Lipa twice in relation to the same song. But these cases are usually fought in the American courts, whereas the Shape of You litigation has been filed in the UK and is being fought in the High Court in London, which makes it particularly interesting. And we're not just saying that. Despite just having dismissed a load of American recorded music stats as not being important enough, we're not just saying that because we're a UK-based podcast. We're partly saying it because we're a UK-based podcast. But in the US, most of these cases are filed with the Californian courts, which makes recent rulings in the Ninth Circuit Appeals Court, particularly the Stairway to Heaven ruling, very influential. And it has to be said that the Ninth Circuit has seemed quite cautious in recent years about concluding that where two songs contain some musical elements in common, the newer song must be infringing the copyright in the former song, which seems sensible. But what about copyright law in the UK? How do UK judges deal with these matters? Well, through this case, we should find out.
Which is why we are right to put a full section of this week's set list on this case. So much more interesting
also,
than US.
It's been so much fun. I've really enjoyed it.
So much more interesting than US record industry stats.
Oh, everything's up. There are numbers.
There are numbers. And of course,
Ed Sheeran got accused of being a squirrel. I'm sure we'll get to that.
And a magpie along the way. Plus a sneak preview of some new Ed Sheeran music. It's been quite an eventful week. But before we get into the nitty-gritty of what happened last week in the High Court with this case, let's just do the background of what this litigation is all about. So, Ed Sheeran is accused of ripping off a 2015 track called OY by two guys called Sammy Chokri and Ross O'Donoghue. Actually, it was Sheeran and his songwriting collaborators on Shape of You who actually went legal first, because after Chokri and O'Donoghue had raised an issue in saying, we're pretty sure that new Ed Sheeran hit rips off our earlier track, well, as a result of that complaint, all the PRS money due on the Ed Sheeran track got frozen, as sometimes happens in cases like this. Keen to get their hands on all of that PRS money, for which there was an awful lot with this track, Sheeran and his collaborators basically went to get court confirmation that their track did not infringe the earlier track, which then prompted Chokri and O'Donoghue to file their own counterclaim for copyright infringement. Now, of course, regular listeners of Setlist, again, will know, because we've talked about a lot of these cases on the podcast over the years, and the basic principle is the same here in the UK as in the US. In order for Chokri and O'Donoghue to prove that Sheeran and his collaborators infringed their work when they wrote Shape of You, first of all, it needs to be proven that Ed Sheeran and his collaborators, so that includes Johnny McDade from Snow Patrol, a regular collaborator with Sheeran, either Sheeran or McDade or someone else involved in writing Shape of You needs to have heard OY before they wrote their song. Plus, of course, we have to put the two songs side by side and prove that they have certain sections in common, which they do. But then the debate is, well, how similar are the different elements of the song and how substantial are the elements, the musical elements, the lyrical elements that the two songs have in common? Are they close enough similar enough, and substantial enough for there to be a case of copyright infringement. Needless to say, Sharon McDade and their team deny having ever heard OY before they wrote Shape of You, and they also insist that the elements that the two songs share are pretty commonplace when it comes to pop music.
In court, the lawyer representing Chokri and O'Donoghue, Andrew Sutcliffe, has tried to argue that Sheeran in particular consumes loads of music and is prone to nabbing elements of songs he likes to include in his own songs when he writes them. And, as we mentioned, along the way declared Sheeran to be both a musical magpie and a musical squirrel. On the first day of proceedings, Sutcliffe stated that Ed Sheeran is undeniably very talented. He is a genius, but he is also a magpie. He borrows ideas and throws them into his songs. He also argued that when Sheeran borrows from famous songs and famous songwriters, he acknowledges that fact and does a deal with those famous songwriters. However, when he borrows from less famous songs and less famous songwriters, he is less likely to acknowledge or pay for the borrowing. But in both a written statement and on the witness stand, Sheeran denied that that was true.
Yeah, so Sheeran did concede that, like most songwriters, it has to be said, he is clearly influenced by other songs, and that sometimes an element of one of his songs is sufficiently similar to an earlier song that he and his people do sometimes say, maybe we have borrowed an element from that earlier song, maybe we should find the writers and the publishers of that song and do a little bit of a deal to ensure there were no problems down the line. And indeed, one deal of that kind was also done in relation to Shape of You, specifically with the writers of TLC's 1999 hit No Scrubs. We knew that, actually. The deal was confirmed after Shape of You had been released, although it came up in court last week that talks with the writers of No Scrubs had actually begun before the record was released. However, while Sheeran is conceding that he is influenced by other songs, and while that sometimes results in deals like the No Scrubs deal being done, that does not mean, he was keen to stress, that he is constantly lifting from other people's work. And if he does in a specific way, he is always super careful to make sure that whoever the person who wrote the earlier work is, and however famous they may be, if he has borrowed something from another song, or he has been influenced in a way that you could say that he has, that he reaches out to that person and does a deal. So, Sheeran said, and I quote, "I have always tried to be completely fair in crediting anyone who makes any contribution to any song I write. I do refer to other works on occasion when I write, as do many songwriters. If there is a reference to another work, I notify my team so that steps can be taken to obtain clearance. I have been as scrupulous as I possibly can and have even given credits to people who I believe may have been no more than a mere influence for a songwriting element. This is because I want to treat other songwriters fairly." He then went into more detail in terms of countering this argument that, okay, he does those deals with the superstars and the big songs, but he's not interested in acknowledging lesser-known songwriters. "Not so," said Sheeran. He insisted that actually he has done deals with lesser-known artists and songwriters. He cited Shivers and Visiting Hours and an unknown composer who had contributed some music to Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And he said, "All those examples are not famous artists that we've cleared songs with, and that's what I have to say on that."
Later in the week, we also got both a written statement and in-person testimony from Johnny McDade, who we mentioned earlier, who said, "I have been a professional songwriter for many years and have achieved substantial success. I do not need or want to, nor would I ever plagiarise other people's work. The idea is abhorrent to me." Both Sheeran and McDade also expanded on the argument that the elements that OY and Shape of You share are commonplace in pop music. When asked if his song and Chokri's song had very similar melodies, Sheeran said, "Fundamentally, yes, they are based around the minor pentatonic scale and they both have vowels in them." However, he insisted, that wasn't because he had Chokri's track in mind when writing his own song. It was just a common melody that is often found in pop music. And to illustrate that point, he also sang elements of other songs where it can be heard, like Feeling Good, best known it's being sung by Nina Simone, and the Blackstreet track No Diggity. And he said, if you put them all in the same key, they'll sound the same.
In fact, Sheeran also admitted during this part of his testimony, while writing Shape of You, he had actually realised that part of the song was a little bit too close to No Diggity. And that actually was an admission that led to a bit of an explanation that gave us some interesting insight into how Sheeran and his team deal with the problem of his new songs inevitably having elements in them that sound a bit like existing songs. In fact, there were some audio clips cited from the Shape of You recording sessions in which Sheeran can actually be heard suggesting that a key part of the song's melody be changed because it was, and I quote, a bit close to the bone. Explaining what that meant in court, Sheeran said, "We thought it was a bit too close to a song called No Diggity by Blackstreet. I said we should change that." But, and this is the interesting bit, it wasn't just Sheeran who was monitoring his new songs for elements that could be said to rip off existing songs. He also told the court that a musicologist had reviewed the original version of Shape of You and identified similarities also with the Bill Withers song Grandma's Hands and the aforementioned TLC track No Scrubs. Tweaks were made as a result, he confirmed, plus that aforementioned deal with the writers of No Scrubs was done. As I say, that deal wasn't actually finalised until after the release of Shape of You, but Sheeran insisted they had reached out to those writers pre-release. It's just that they hadn't got back to them in time to get it sorted before Shape of You was put out.
Now, as well as discussing the similarities between the two songs, there was also the question as to whether Sheeran and McDade had heard OY before writing Shape of You in the autumn of 2016. The Chokri and Donahue side argued that both Sheeran and Chokri, who performs as Sammy Switch, had been championed by SBTV, meaning that Sheeran had probably heard Chokri's record. This was also where the squirrel thing came in. Sutcliffe argued that Sheeran is a musical squirrel, constantly listening to new music and storing up ideas. And maybe he'd heard OY in 2015, grabbed some ideas from it and stored them up, ready for his recording sessions in 2016. Sheeran insisted, however, that while early in his career he had stored up ideas for songs over a period of time, by 2016 he had a much more impromptu approach to songwriting. And these days when he writes, it's much more spontaneous in the studio, with him and his collaborators coming up with and sharing ideas in the moment. So describing his current songwriting approach, he said, "There is no premeditated thought process. I simply make things up as I go along, and if it sounds good, I keep it. I think of them as sort of excitement bottles. If a song is working, the excitement pushes it to the point where it's finished. If it's not, then I'll leave it and move on to something else." However, after that, Sutcliffe suggested that perhaps Ed Sheeran had still squirreled away some ideas he got from listening to OY and then subconsciously used them when writing Shape of You. Although Sheeran pointed out that he pretty much went off-grid in the year before writing Shape of You, cutting himself off from social media and new music, and making that theory much less likely to be true.
Another theme throughout the week in court was that past accusations of song theft that have been made against Sheeran and the deals he has done along the way with other songwriters, like the deal he did with the No Scrubs songwriters, all suggested that Sheeran did indeed have a history of lifting musical ideas from other artists' work. In particular, Sutcliffe brought up a lawsuit filed over another song that Sheeran co-wrote with McDade, that being Photograph. In that case, Sheeran and McDade were accused of ripping off the Matt Cardle track Amazing. However, with that lawsuit, they settled rather than allowing it to proceed to court. So Sutcliffe suggested that that was because Sheeran and McDade recognised that the other side had a strong case. But you will not be surprised to hear, both Sheeran and McDade strongly disagreed with that claim.
Yes, they both said that they do not believe that Photograph infringed Amazing, but they were advised that an out-of-court settlement was the speedy way to make that particular dispute go away. So McDade told the court that that lawsuit was not settled because we believed that we had copied Amazing in any way, but he said that the lawsuit was filed at a time when there was a culture of US copyright trials which were not going favourably for songwriters at all.
And actually, he kind of has a point there. As long-time listeners of Setlist may remember, and indeed we said at the very start of this section, there have been quite a lot of cases of this kind, usually in the US courts, in recent years. And the Photograph lawsuit was filed the year after the sometimes controversial ruling in the big Blurred Lines song theft case over in the US. And that was the ruling that it was felt at the time had possibly set a precedent which was going to open up more songwriters, particularly songwriters on big hits, to claims that their songs had ripped off earlier songs in a way that constituted copyright infringement. Now, by the time Sharon and McDade settled the Photograph lawsuit in 2017, we had had the first judgment in the other US case that arguably restricted the impact of the Blurred Lines judgment, that being the aforementioned Stairway to Heaven case. In summer 2016, I think between the Photograph case being filed but before it was settled, I think I'm getting the chronology right here. It's so confusing. In summer 2016, a jury had decided that Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven was not sufficiently similar to the earlier song Taurus to constitute copyright infringement. And that was a ruling that seemed to restrict the potential impact of what had happened in the Blurred Lines case. Although it has to be said that that ruling was then appealed and it went through quite a complicated appeals process. And it wasn't until 2020 that the Ninth Circuit Appeals Court in the US basically confirmed and set in stone the ruling in the Stairway to Heaven case. So, as a result, McDade is right to say that in the context of 2017, many music lawyers would probably have concluded that even if Sharon and McDade rejected outright the song theft claims that had been made against them by the writers of Amazing, nevertheless, he and Sharon were probably better off settling the Photograph litigation rather than getting pulled into a test case in what at that point was something of an uncertain legal environment. Especially as, by that point, Sharon was actually already involved in another test case on this topic in the US, that being the lawsuit related to Thinking Out Loud, which he co-wrote with Amy Wodge. And actually, that case is still working its way through the courts. And I mean, who would want to be involved in two test cases at the same time?
Or indeed three, I suppose, given that this legal battle with Chocri and O'Donoghue kicked off the following year in 2018. Anyway, as we record this, this court case is still happening in the High Court and we're expecting it to run for another couple of weeks. So we'll be covering it in the CMU Daily as we have been all week. There's a lot more detail if you want to go back and read those reports. And it'll be interesting to see how the High Court rules. And also, if we get any more sneak previews of new Ed Sheeran records, because at one point last week, with lawyers playing various snippets of music to illustrate their points, someone accidentally played a bit of an unreleased Sheeran track off the laptop of another of his collaborators, Steve Mack, much to Sheeran's annoyance. So maybe we'll get to hear some more new music as well as some important legal precedents as this case proceeds. And finally, on this edition of Setlist, as promised, LimeWire is back. Yes, indeed. Everyone's favourite peer-to-peer file-sharing software after Napster has returned. Except now it's not a piece of file-sharing software. It's a music-focused NFT marketplace.
Yes, brothers and serial online entrepreneurs Julian and Paul Zehetmeyer are behind this whole new LimeWire venture, having, according to Bloomberg, spent much of the last year securing the rights in the famous former P2P file sharing brand. And the idea that these guys have is they're going to take the LimeWire brand that everybody remembers and they're going to attach it to a music NFT platform. Obviously, there are many music NFT platforms out there at the moment, but their plan is to create an NFT platform that anybody can use based on the idea, and probably the pretty solid idea, that actually buying NFTs is still quite complicated for more mainstream music fans.
Yes, I would say the vast majority of people do not have the necessary knowledge of and comfort with trading in cryptocurrency that's needed to purchase NFTs. And so Paul Zehetmeyer explains, the biggest challenge with digital collectibles and the broader crypto market in general is that it's really limited to a small group of savvy users. There are big players on the market already, but the entry barrier is still too big to allow for mainstream adoption. If you're an average music fan on the internet, he goes on, you might not own any cryptocurrency or have access to a crypto wallet, let alone understand the mechanics of collectibles on the blockchain. We want to remove all of those obstacles and make it easy for people to participate, while at the same time offering an exciting platform for crypto natives.
Let's never forget those all-important crypto natives, which it might still turn out are the only audience for NFTs. But of course, we're all hoping, I say we, I mean the music industry, that it turns out that lots of other people are excited about NFTs as well. Now, this new LimeWire NFT marketplace isn't set to properly launch until May, but the company reckons that it's already got some big name artists ready to drop some non-fungible tokens via their platform. Plus, it has a number of music industry figures on its advisory board. Those include the general manager for Wu-Tang Clan, Wu Music Group, that being Tarif Michael, former Def Jam A&R Pedro Gineo, and artist managers Brett Fisher and Janine McLean.
Yes, so they're talking a big game, but I think the big question nonetheless is why? And I don't mean that in my usual, oh God, why are NFTs even a thing kind of way that, you know, you've all heard. I mean more, why LimeWire? Why did they think that the name of a defunct illegal file sharing service would be the perfect thing to slap on the front of their apparently legit NFT marketplace? I mean, is it that they reckon that people who used to download music for free on LimeWire and feel nostalgic about those days are now older and have a bit of spare money knocking around that they can use to spend on pretending to own a JPEG? Or do they reckon that the name will pique the interest of journalists like us here and make it more likely that we'll talk about it over their rivals? And I mean, well, if it's the latter of those, then job done.
Yeah, and it may well be that it's a mix of both of those things. People do recognise the brand, it has to be said. And I guess, I suppose younger music fans who arrived kind of beyond file sharing, even too young for the Pirate Bay and Kick-Ass. Those music fans do exist, sadly, who came along in the YouTube, MySpace, Spotify, TikTok age, may not be aware of LimeWire, but there are plenty of people who are very much still aware of that brand. So maybe there is a logic to acquiring the rights to the name and using it for this new NFT marketplace. Although, when you're trying to get the wider music industry on board, well, LimeWire didn't end very well in terms of its relationship with the music industry. It was basically sued out of business. It was one of the big targets when the music industry was going through its litigation period, trying to sue all those P2P software companies out of business, which, I mean, basically it ultimately did. So, yes, it might attract journalists. It might attract a certain age of music fan. But will it harm their relationships with the music industry? Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, for those that don't remember, it was one of the most popular file sharing services to emerge after Napster was shut down. And like Napster, it did attempt to become a licensed service. I actually remember meeting with someone who worked on that like legit LimeWire service. And he said he took it to one of the major label execs and he pitched the idea to him, you know, and he went through everything they were going to do and how it was going to work, and he got to the end and the label exec said, I love it, I think it's great, I think it's brilliant, it's really really good, I am still going to sue you out of business. So it, yes, there was quite a lot of ill will.
Yeah, like Napster, I guess, although in the latter part of its history, it was trying to go legit and some people in the industry thought that was a good idea. But I think what most people in the industry remember about LimeWire was it was one of the last big legal battles against a P2P file sharing company. And it was one that was ultimately successful for the music industry. In 2010, the LimeWire company, the original LimeWire company, announced that it was closing its doors. A year later, it settled out of court with the major labels, agreeing to pay $105 million in damages. Another settlement then followed in 2012 with Merlin representing the indies. Then, shortly after that, there was an amusing story doing the rounds. Somebody was claiming that the majors were trying to force LimeWire back to the negotiating table, having decided that their $105 million wasn't enough. This turned out not to be true, but it was a funny story because somebody had said that the labels were going for $72 trillion in damages, which was basically they took how many tracks had been shared through LimeWire over the years, multiplied it by the top statutory damages available under US copyright law per infringement, which is $150,000, and that's how you got to $72 trillion. But that is more money than exists in the entire world. So even though that story turned out not to be true, it did get picked up by quite a few websites at the time, and it was quite funny.
Yes, I mean, you know, the labels can and have often been accused of being greedy, but going for more, I mean, there are various different estimates, but people generally settle on there being about $40 trillion in the world. So that would be exceptionally greedy. Other versions of the software were launched by other people not involved with the original company after it was shut down. But by that time, you know, none of them really took off in the same way as their predecessor, in part because, you know, by then streaming was taking off. And also, I mean, in the file sharing domain, the Pirate Bay had become the dominant player.
So here's the question. Will LimeWire, the NFT marketplace, go mainstream like its file sharing namesake did? Its owners presumably hope so. Or will it end, as we feel some NFT projects will? We're not saying this one, but we do sense that there will be some multi-million dollar lawsuits to come out of the whole music NFT thing. And I suppose in a sort of circular sort of way, it would be kind of funny if the LimeWire NFT platform was involved in that. But we're sure that their service is going to be 100% legit, 100% brilliant, 100% explained properly to everybody who spends money. And it's all going to be great. But who knows? We will see.
Yes, only time will tell. But that is all we've got time for on this edition of Setlist. If you want to read more about anything we've discussed on this edition of the podcast, and as I say, there's a lot more Ed Sheeran stuff to get into, go to the show notes for this episode where you'll find links to everything. Those show notes you'll find in your podcast player now or at setlistpodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the show if you haven't already. Rate and review the show if you haven't already, or even if you have. And if you want to discuss anything with us at all that we've talked about on the show or otherwise, email us setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Morton, Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.